The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues of our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice, and it's great to be with you. This week, we know the economic toll of the shutdown has been tough. Josh McDowell looks at the emotional and psychological toll.
These three were epidemics before the lockdown. Think of what they're going to be after the lockdown.
Businesses, churches, and other nonprofits are getting ready to resume activity, but it won't be business as usual. It's a challenge for leadership.
Leadership in times of crisis, that's when leadership matters.
The shelter-at-home orders are running their course. In short, it's because we have succeeded.
The data no longer suggests hospital overcrowding and health system overwhelming is a problem.
We'll hear from Albert Mohler on the tension between church and state in a pandemic.
The Constitution of the United States has not been put on pause.
We've got all this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, your host, and it's great to be with you. I'm coming to you from home, at least for now, and my home station of KPDQ in Portland, Oregon. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. After months of numerous shelter-at-home policies across the nation, we are all aware of the economic toll this pandemic has taken. Upwards of 35 million unemployed workers illustrates only a fraction of the impact. Tens of millions more are working from home, often working for less and working longer while carrying the stress of it all. I guess it should be no surprise that Americans are also struggling emotionally, spiritually, psychologically at this extraordinary time. Josh McDowell, a name familiar to most of you, joined my program on KPDQ here in Portland. This is really quite an event that we are witnessing in that we are required to socially distance from one another. And with that isolation, as you point out in this document that I referenced, 10 challenges facing the church and the part that focuses on the coronavirus, it is exacerbating some problems that we've already seen. And the church, you suggest, needs to be ready. Give us kind of a loose overview.
Well, the thing is, the virus and the lockdown has not caused any of this. What it has done is exasperated it. 3-4 months ago, of every country in the world, every continent globally, there were three major epidemics: pornography, loneliness, and depression. All over the world. This is before anybody even knew about the virus. And so along comes the virus, and what it does, it feeds into these three things. When you become locked down, you're isolated, the stress, the fear, the anxiety it causes, the lack of knowing what's going to happen and all of that feeds into pornography, loneliness, and depression. And what I'm trying to get across to parents and churches and educators, when we come out of this, which will be in a month maybe or 2 months, when we come out of this, we better be ready to address pornography, loneliness, and depression. Because if these three were epidemics before the lockdown, think of what they're going to be after the lockdown. The call-in to call centers for help, emotionally and all, has gone up 500%. Mm. That's huge. And most people don't know where to turn to. And so that's why I did that document. And I'm spending so much time on my website preparing things to help people in loneliness, pornography, and depression. Because it's here, but we're not aware of it yet.
Now, what would you attribute this loneliness, addiction to pornography, and so on, that's a pandemic, if you will, all over the globe, to what do you attribute these elements that are undermining a life of that's thriving?
Well, there's two things for what I'm going to say. One, it mostly started around 2006, 2008, all over the world. Second, there's one item that is in every culture of the world, in the jungles everywhere, and that's the cell phone. And the cell phone came out, the smartphone, about 2007, 2008. And what is happening, especially those 35 and under, they're learning to communicate with their thumbs, not with their tongues. Through the internet, we are connecting, but we're not relating.
Mm.
And we were made for relationships. Harvard did an 80-year study. Can you imagine that, 80 years? It started during the Great Depression, and they just released it. And they wanted to find out, is there one thing that would determine happiness and healthiness later in life? Is there anything? After 80 years of research, they found one thing, and that was relationships. Didn't matter if you're rich or poor, educated, uneducated, churched or not churched, whatever, relationships was a key factor into health and happiness. And that is true today, but we're learning to connect with our thumbs. And so that, there's many reasons for it. Another cause of it is the breakdown of the father relationship, which has just gradually diminished over the years. It's starting to correct itself now. But when a child grows up without a loving, intimate connection with their father, there's tremendous mental health, emotional consequences in their life. And one is loneliness. Another is depression. That's why I've tried to make such an issue of this. And people can go to my website, josh.org/loneliness. I have incredible material there. You can download it all free.
Now, one of the documents that you produce there is What Comes Next? What will life be like after COVID-19 pandemic? And you reflect on possible trends that we might anticipate. The first that you write is the economic climate. I think it's difficult to fully appreciate what life might be like when things open up for those who have suffered the greatest economic harm. Can you talk a bit about the economic climate and how we might anticipate what to expect?
I think it's going to be better. And it would be some significant difference. And it wasn't really, much of it was not caused by the virus again. Mm-hmm. But let me show you what I mean. Back 3-4 months ago, 12-15 of the top businesses in the United States, four-walled box stores and things, like Pier 1 Imports and others, were going to go into bankruptcy. Why? It's not all bad. It's because of the internet, of Target, Walmart and the internet, but mainly because of Amazon. And way back before the lockdown and the virus scare, the economy was going to change. And so now when we come out of this, most of those that were going to go into bankruptcy will not recover from the virus.
As businesses, churches, and other not-for-profits navigate this crisis, the path forward beyond the shelter-at-home policies is loaded with challenge. Simply put, it's a test for leaders. Don Crow, my colleague on WAVA in Washington, D.C., turned to Pat Gelsinger, an outspoken believer and the CEO of the tech firm VMware.
In general, how would you define leadership?
Well, obviously leadership, most people look at it, the person sitting in front. But I'd say, it's easy to be standing in front of a parade when the party's going well. Right? Leadership in times of crisis and difficulties, that's when leadership matters. That's when you truly see what a leader looks like. That's when you see the qualities where, and as I describe in this period of time, where you need to be empathetic, right? You need to be transparent. You don't know everything, but you're still taking responsibility. Communicate, communicate, communicate. You just can't do enough of it in this period of time. And finally, set a vision for the future, right? For lack of a vision, the people perish. And now's the time where they're looking for where are we going? And just, I'll say, the utter confidence that you exude to your teams that, yeah, we are going to get to the other side. I've been through tough times before, and we're going to get through this tough time, and we're going to do it together.
I understand you have 5 leadership principles and also a leadership code. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I call it the five L's of leadership, and I give a leadership talk to different settings. And, you know, the five L's, one is listen. You know, nobody cares how much you know until they know you care. And here it's really to listen. And God gave you two ears, one mouth, use them in proportion. I also have a little funny phrase I use that's HIPPO, right? Highest paid person's opinion. And if I'm the senior person in the meeting and I start to pollute it with my opinion, everybody just sort of settles around my idea. You don't get any diversity of thought. So first, you have to listen. You know, second, you have to learn, right? You have to build a learning organization. I want to make new mistakes, right? Learn from everyone that you can around you, build a learning organization and one that really embraces your failures, because you don't grow in times of success. You grow in times of failure, in times of challenge, right? Also that you link. And you know, I say one of my jobs as a leader is, I have two of my people, you guys got to work together. I got to bring you together. And if one of you is complaining about the other, get out of my office, go work with the other person and come back with a shared proposal, linking and bringing the teams together. Also that you lift. When stuff looks bad, your job as a leader is to be that person that is lifting the organization. One of the pastors out here said, I must be encouraged so I can be an encouragement. And when you walk into the building, the workplace, you join that virtual call, if your spirits are lifting those of everybody else's, they say, my leader knows more than I do, and they're looking more positive than I think it is. They must know more, and it must be better than I thought it was, lifting the organization. And finally, love. And here it may sound like a funny word to use in a busy business context, but just love your people, love your teams, love your companies. And if you can't just be truly and deeply committed to the success of the teams, the organizations, the families, the communities they represent, you're probably not in the right chair. Get out of it and get somebody in it who does exude that passion for their teams and organizations. So those are my quick five L's of leadership, and believe there's something in that for most any leader today. And we as a company, we've put in place what we call our leadership code. And for this, we have the things that we're good at. We call them our skills. The principles that we're going to operate the company by, our mindsets, and finally, our values. And these leadership code and our core values have really guided us well as a company.
Coming up, the tense relations between the state and institutions of faith.
The Constitution of the United States has not been put on pause. There is no exemption for religious liberty.
Albert Mohler, coming up in the Christian Outlook. The COVID-19 pandemic has strained the limits of our constitutional system. But over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Hi, I'm Jim Daly with Focus on the Family. The coronavirus pandemic has made life chaotic and unpredictable for everyone. It's in times like these we search for something we can truly count on. We need a true north. In the current crisis, I believe true north is loving your neighbor as yourself. And we can do that by using our time and talent and resources to help assist someone who is vulnerable or in need. And let's remember, together we'll get through this.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. Wherever you are in our great nation, I think it's a pretty good guess that there's been some frustration in your world with the government's response to the coronavirus. Whether it's too slow to respond to the threat, too slow on testing, or too strict in the lockdown, we've heard and seen it all. Fortunately, a number of states, even some blue states, are now moving out of lockdown, and that's a sign of progress. Lanhee Chen of the Hoover Institution serves as an editorial board member for Salem. He joined Craig Roberts on KFAX in San Francisco.
Why do we see such a disjointed fashion in which there seems to be a misapplication where some states are going completely overboard, others not far enough? Why is this?
Well, you're asking exactly the right question, and I think not only are you finding inconsistencies between states, but as you noted very well in the data between different parts of the San Francisco Bay Area you're noticing differences there as well. Look, when this whole crisis initially started, you had a coordinated effort between the different Bay Area counties and the city of San Francisco to come up with a plan in terms of keeping people sheltered in place. And what was the justification for that? We said, look, we don't want the health care, they don't want the healthcare system to be overburdened. They don't want hospitals to be overburdened. Perfectly reasonable rationale. Most people in this area took it very seriously and said, look, we're going to do our part, even though it's a tough thing to do. We're going to do our part. The problem is now we're several months into this shutdown, and the data no longer suggests that hospital overcrowding and health system overwhelming is a problem. In fact, we've gotten to a relatively low point of transmission in several counties, and the likelihood that we overwhelm intensive care units in hospitals in the Bay Area is extremely low. So what's the justification now? And this is the problem, you see. The goals keep shifting. And not only that, but you've got different counties, some of which are right next to each other, making very different decisions about when they're going to lift their stay-at-home orders, when they're going to allow for people to go out and resume somewhat normal activity. None of this makes any kind of sense in any rational, quote, data-driven, science-driven world. And you cannot continue to wield power in a way that is unaccountable, where you don't explain what your thinking is, or you merely say, if you don't follow my dictates, you want to kill people. You're responsible for people's lives if you don't follow my public health orders. That's not good enough anymore. We need to hear why, we need to hear how, and we need to understand how these policymakers are arriving at the decisions they're arriving at.
Another key point of tension as states emerge out of stay-at-home ordinances is the relationship between our secular government and communities of faith. I suppose we shouldn't be too surprised. Albert Mohler explains from his briefing program.
When you look at what's going on in the United States, and in particular with many Christian churches, but perhaps most pressingly in Europe amongst Roman Catholics, with Catholics demanding to be able to go back to their churches, back to the sacraments, you can understand what's going on here. The big pattern is that it is theistic religion. It is a religion that claims a revelatory authority that is clamoring to be able to get back to religious assemblies. There are, needless to say, massive theological differences between Muslims and Orthodox Jews and Christians, and, of course, between evangelical Christians and Roman Catholics. There are vast areas of disagreement. But what every single one of these systems claims is a divine revelation and an authority on which to make demands that can even supersede the government. Here's a very interesting question for our secular age. In an increasingly secular society, just how out of step is it for someone to say that we bear a higher allegiance than to the government? That's something that is becoming increasingly clear as you consider the mainstream media and many in politics. There's a partisan divide here, to be sure. It is simply a matter of pattern that in the United States, Democratic governors have been far slower to respond to many of these religious concerns in general than Republican governors. Those states have a very clear pattern. At the same time, you have the President of the United States who has leaned in, and as of the last several days, you also have federal courts that have leaned in. Not all of that is explicitly partisan, but much of it is. But in looking at all of this, especially the mainstream media coverage, one of the interesting things is the fact that there are so many in the media, and perhaps predictably also in politics, who simply don't understand their neighbors and fellow citizens who believe that we bear a responsibility to not forsake the assembling of ourselves together. And group by group, there are different imperatives. Among Roman Catholics, a very strong sacramentalism. Among Muslims, a very strong claim of necessary obedience. Among Orthodox Jews, again, the claim that they have the right and the responsibility to order themselves according to Jewish law. And when it comes to evangelical Christians, the fact is that most of the headline stories in recent days have had to do with one evangelical church or denomination or another. When it comes to those who are operating from a more secular worldview or a secular point of view, do they understand that there would be any authority that would trump the authority of the state, that is, of the secular government? Very interesting. We're left with the realization that if you are operating from a secular worldview, you obviously are rejecting a religious or theistic authority. You do not believe that there is any theological authority above the authority of the state, and so you're quite suspicious of your fellow citizens when they claim allegiance to such an authority. It can sound downright subversive to secularists. And there's even more to it than that. If you are talking to someone from a secular worldview, it might be that there would be two realities, or at least two abstractions, that even the more liberal and secular-minded might say is above the authority of the state. One might be some form of a moral norm or a moral law. This is what we see, for example, when there are people who say, I'm going to go over my own government to go to something like in Europe, which is the European Court of Human Rights, in order to say, I'm going to appeal to a higher moral or legal authority. The second thing, as an abstraction that might be at work here, is that at least some amongst those who are more secular might think that there could be some kind of governmental or international body above that of the nation state, something like the United Nations, where an appeal can be made. But other than that, according to a secular worldview, if consistent, there really is no authority over the government to which anyone should appeal or to which anyone owes obedience. But this just points to the fact that in an increasingly secular world, those who are serious Catholics and serious evangelicals, we find ourselves seriously confronted with the fact that there are so many, especially in the elites of our society, who are operating from a secular worldview, and our worldview then looks strange. It's odd. It's eccentric and out of date. It's on the wrong side of history that someone would claim a theistic authority. And furthermore, all this imperative about worship and gathering together, how would you explain that? It's out of sync with a secular society. It's strange. But furthermore, that strange is translated into sinister. There are those who actually believe that there is a higher law than the law of the government, the law of the state. To the secular mind, that is not only strange, it's frightening. There are massive questions at the intersection of Christian responsibility, religious liberty, and efforts to try to limit the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic. Quite legitimately, there are difficult decisions to be made by government, and state by state, we're watching these decisions being made. Some of them will not stand the test of time, and others will. All these governors and governmental authorities are going to have to recognize that the Constitution of the United States has not been put on pause. There is no exemption for religious liberty. At the same time, I have been arguing that Christians, motivated by love of God, and that means obedience to God's word, and love of neighbor, ought to take every reasonable measure to try to limit the spread of COVID-19 and ought to obey generally applicable orders, not those that are targeted at religion.
Coming up, a Christian sociologist looks at America in a pandemic.
When we are uncomfortable, God is growing us.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
The Christian Outlook podcast brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. That's 800-654-3969, or click on the banner ad at ChristianOutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. Today, we've talked about how this pandemic has created a host of challenges for us all. Our next guest argues that in addition to practical challenges, the pandemic has hit us where we are spiritually the weakest. Christine Jeske is a sociologist, an author, and a professor at Wheaton College. She's lived in Wisconsin, Nicaragua, China, and South Africa. She explained her point to John Hall and Kathy Emmons on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
What are the things that you think we in America hold on to most tightly?
Yeah, so, you know, I realized when the shelter in place order went into place, it struck me one morning that if like 6 months ago, somebody had asked me to compare the United States to other places I've lived and ask where we're spiritually weakest in comparison to the rest of the world, three things that probably would have come at the top of my list would be our materialism, our love of money, and how we use money. Our fear of missing out, our kind of sense that we have to be productive every moment of every day and kind of think our identity is all about our work, and our kind of ignorance of mortality, that we go through life ignoring the fact that we will die and that we are mortal beings. And the pandemic, I realized, hit all of these so squarely. And so, yeah, that's, you know, what we're suffering is not just a sort of material fear of sickness, but it's also readjusting all these ways that we think about our existence.
Right, right. So you brought up the love of money. And I think you were right to say it's not even with most people. Well, I don't want to say, well, how can I speak for most people? But I think it's likely that it's oftentimes more looking to work as satisfaction, as some kind of identity, even more than it is the money we get from our work.
Yeah. This is something that even 100 years ago, Max Weber wrote this book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. And one of the things he pointed out there, and this was not from a Christian perspective, but just sort of a historian's perspective, he said, Christians in America, and particularly Protestant Christians, even 100 years ago, were odd in that they would work and work and not do it because they were getting more money, but just because they had this firm sense that they had to keep working. And mm-hmm. this is something that I've noticed too, as I travel around the world, that Americans are particularly geared toward work. You know, if you ask somebody to introduce themselves, chances are one of the very first things they're going to say is what their job is. Mm-hmm. We see work as our identity, and we work for money, but even the things that we buy with our money are not so much because we're greedy and we want to just have more and more stuff. It's because those things define us and they show the world who we are and they show the world our status. And we have this sense that we have to keep getting the new stuff so that we project the right status in our kind of social world.
Christine, let's talk in our last couple of minutes about FOMO. That's what we call it here in our household, fear of missing out.
Yeah.
What does that highlight for us?
Yeah, so I wrote this article for Christianity Today, and I originally didn't include that one because to me, in my 40s, what struck me was the money and the mortality aspects of it. But as I started listening to my students in their 20s processing this and my high school kids, I realized, wow, FOMO is also what's getting hit here, this fear of missing out. Again, this comes back a little bit to our desire for productivity all the time, this sense that we have to be doing something to be meaningful. And it's not just our things that define us, but our activities. So, you know, being a part of the choir, being a part of that sport, that's forming the sort of outward identity of a young person, especially, but all of us. Yes. And so we lose those activities and it feels like we don't know who we are. We don't know what our purpose is anymore. And this is exactly the time when we need to come back to the truth of what is our purpose. Our purpose is not in what we accomplish. And, you know, we can point to Bible verses that say that, but in our everyday life, often we live that way, thinking if I haven't done something at the end of the day, if I haven't seen that friend, had that experience, then what was it for?
Right. So in the midst of all this, then, Christine, how are you wearing the pandemic? Does it suit you well or is it uncomfortable?
Oh, I think it's uncomfortable for all of us. And that's why I challenge us to think about these things right now, because I think when we are uncomfortable, God is growing us. And not that God asked for this pandemic or gave it to us as retribution, but God can work through this time that our sort of suffering can produce new growth in our spiritual lives. So I see this as a time when we have amazing opportunities to restructure so many things about life. We can restructure the ways that our churches interact. We can restructure the ways that our government works. We can restructure all kinds of things because suddenly everything is being questioned. And I think we need to turn those questions to the Lord and ask, you know, what are the structures that you want us to have right now? How do you want us to regard wealth and productivity?
Coming up, a Christian perspective on death.
We've tended in modern culture, modern Western society anyway, to put death very much to the margins, to keep it invisible.
When the Christian Outlook returns, in a moment, stay with us. The COVID-19 pandemic has strained the limits of our constitutional system. But over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice.
In our last segment, Christine Jeske, she talked about how our culture tends to deny our mortality, deny the fact that we are all dying. We idolize and elevate youth and youth culture and just don't like to think too much about death, particularly our own. As a culture, we have drifted quite far from a biblical perspective on death. Here's Carl Truman of Grove City College, also a guest of John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
All I can think of is the inescapability of death. Now, it sounds obvious, but I mean, not just that it's going to happen to each one of us, but it's the shadow that lays over all of our lives. Now, it happens all the time, but in times that are not pandemic related, I think it's easier to forget about. You know, you read your book, you go to work, you watch your movie, you work out or whatever, and you kind of try to keep those thoughts at bay. But at times like this, it's in everyone's thinking all the time.
Yeah, I would agree. And in fact, I would sort of make it more intense than that in some ways. And I think we've lived certainly the last 20, 30, 40 years in an era where not only have we routinely ignored death, as many generations before us have done that, but we've kind of shoved death to the margins. So we are singularly ill-prepared, I think, to handle it. It occasionally intervenes in our lives with maybe the death of a loved one or a friend. But you know, if you were to go back 100, 150, 200 years, you go to church on a Sunday, probably you walk past the graveyard where your ancestors, your parents are buried. Probably growing up, you'd have known people from a very early age who died. We've tended in modern culture, modern Western society anyway, to put death very much to the margins, to keep it invisible. And now, of course, as you pointed out, it's exploded onto the scene in a rather unavoidable way. And I don't think we have the personal cultural resources for addressing that in a way that previous generations might have done.
Yeah. Carl, I just finished a book, which was, it's called Shoe Dog. And it's the story of Phil Knight, who was the founder of Nike. Phil Knight, from a very young age, was obsessed with running. And so much so that he flew to Japan in 1961 to try to extract a shoe contract from the Japanese. And as he's leaving, his grandmother is saying, "Don't go to Japan, Phil. Those people, they're surrounded by death. The atomic bomb was there. They tried to kill us in World War II." And he gets there in Japan, and like, it's 1961. It's like 15 years after the end of World War II. And the economy's surging. The people are on fire with innovation. He kind of shrugs his shoulders and goes, "These people are resilient. They look death in the eye, and they've moved on."
And there's something admirable about that, obviously. I mean, there's a sense in which we shouldn't live every day of our lives assuming that we're not going to make it to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, we're going to be snuffed out before then. But I think there's also a realism that we have relative to our lives. If we're going to have any kind of hierarchy of goods in the way we think about time and the way we think about how we use our energy. Mm-hmm. And also, at a time like this, say in the pandemic, when it's very clear that at some point the governments, the governing authorities have got to balance risk over against life in general. It's very hard to do that, I think, if you've managed to con yourself into thinking that if we can just get the technology and the techniques right, we are going to live forever. We're not. We have to reckon with death in a whole number of spheres, I think.
Carl, I think it's interesting that depending on the person, depending on the outlook or the worldview, death can render life very meaningful or meaningless. How can it do both?
I think for a Christian perspective, death is something that is a reminder to us of the judgment that's to come. I think it's a reminder to us that we are to use the time we have here on earth in a constructive, a positive way. We're to use our time to glorify God, to love God, and to love our neighbor. I think if you lack a religious conviction, then you end up really with a situation rather like that articulated by the 19th century philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who he does this sort of thought experiment where he essentially challenges his readers to think that, you know, if you were to come back and relive your life over and over again for all eternity, how would you live every moment? And the answer, of course, is you live every moment for pleasure. And I think that we live in a world today where, because there is this nihilistic approach to death, because death is the end, we absorb ourselves in the pleasure of the moment. Because life is meaningless, if you like, every moment takes on a kind of eternal meaning. We have to fill it with as much personal pleasure and satisfaction as we possibly can.
So is it a matter of scarcity when it comes to, you know, number of days? Do you think that's what it is? Let me tell you a conversation I had just today, Carl. I was in the Strip District doing some grocery shopping with my daughter, and we were talking about blueberries. And fresh blueberries are really only good for a 2.5 month period, right? So you can get them other times, but they're just not, they're not worth having. And having a frozen blueberry is just a whole different thing, right? So there's something about that 2.5 month period. Now, we were talking about our ability to really enjoy a food we like that much for a very short period of time. Or if we looked at it backwards, it would be depressing because every day that we're eating blueberries is another day that they're going to go away.
Yes, so I see the analogy, yeah. And I think there is a sense in which death the English philosopher Roger Scruton says that, you know, death is actually what makes life meaningful, because it's a finite quality. Therefore, we should come to make sure not that every moment is dedicated to personal pleasure, but that every moment is filled with value, that we should learn to live for the moment, not in terms of a kind of hedonism, but in terms of learning to appreciate the ordinary things in life. You're sitting on a deck, having a glass of wine with friends, for example, would have been one of the things that Roger Scruton pointed to. So certainly I think the finiteness of life can help us to understand the value of the particular moment, if you like. I would want to avoid, though, the radical hedonism that says just live for the moment. I think that's something definitely to be avoided, because life is not to be lived just for oneself. One life is to be lived for God, and life is to be lived for other people, I think.
Coming up?
The church's task is not to con people into thinking that death isn't as terrible as it is.
Right.
The church's task is to acknowledge the power and the terribleness of death, and then point people beyond it to the resurrection.
More from Carl Truman in the last segment of the Christian Outlook. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. As we endeavor to align our thinking about life and death with Scripture, we should do so by rejecting the notion that death is no big deal. What we need to embrace heartily and joyfully is that there is hope beyond the grave. A glorious hope gained only by Christ's defeat of death on the cross and the victory gained by his empty tomb and his ascension, where he is seated at the right hand of the Father. Let's catch a few final moments of Carl Truman on The Ride Home with John and Kathy.
So, Carl, you talk about this in your piece, The Last Enemy, in First Things, that the church, the Christian church itself, in many ways, is complicit with society because we tend to go along with end-of-life celebrations where, you know, now there's, you know, photographs and music and things like that. And so in some ways, even at the very last second, as the person is ascending into the grave itself, the physical grave, we tend to avoid that because it's just too messy or too unwieldy for us to engage in.
Yes, I mean, death is a terrifying prospect. It's often been said by philosophers, it's impossible to imagine your own death, because if you imagine it, you'd be a witness at it, if you like. So death is this boundary that we simply cannot grasp. And I think that leads to us to respond in two ways. One, we could ignore it, which is what we do most of the time. But when you go to a funeral, it's hard to ignore death at that point. As you see the coffin of your loved one load into the ground, you can't ignore the reality of death at that point. So what we try to do then is deceive ourselves into thinking that it's not as bad as it seems. The idea of a celebration of life strikes me as odd, because, you know, when I was at my father's funeral, it was not the happy memories of his life that consoled me. In some ways, the happy memories of his life made the funeral that much more painful, because I was acutely aware of what I'd lost. The church's task is not to con people into thinking that death isn't as terrible as it is.
Right. Yes.
The church's task is to acknowledge the power and the terribleness of death, and then point people beyond it to the resurrection. Mm-hmm. But you can't point people to the resurrection without first acknowledging death. Only dead people are resurrected. That's one of the problems the church has skirted in the modern age. We've not prepared people for the reality of death in the way that we should have done. We need to realize that death is not an illusion. Christ's own death on the cross was not a play act. It was not an illusion. As the Apostles' Creed says in its most contested clause, he descended into hell. If you look at the Book of Common Prayer's liturgy for prayers when you go to visit somebody who's seriously sick, it's very interesting that the prayers are, yes, for healing, but they're also prayers about this person is tasting the judgment that is death at this point. Help them to prepare for what they have to face up to. That's not a note that's often struck in the church today.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. For the complete conversation with Carl Truman, go to our website, christianoutlook.com. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these or other great conversations. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. May God himself be your help, your hope, and your comfort as you continue to pursue him through this great challenge. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.